Welcome to The Beat, a podcast series from the cops office at the Department of Justice, featuring interviews with experts from a varied field of disciplines. The Beat provides law enforcement with the latest developments and trending topics in community policing. Hello, everyone, and welcome. I'm Jennifer Donnell, and thank you for joining us on The Beat. Today, we are so pleased to welcome Noel March. He's the Senior Director for Public Safety and Security and Chief of Police for the University of Southern Maine, where he is responsible for the Department of Public Safety. Prior to his current position, Chief March was the 39th United States Marshal for the District of Maine. He also previously held the position of Director of Public Safety for the University of Maine, where he was a recognized subject matter expert on the topic of community-oriented policing. He's a graduate of the 170th session of the FBI National Academy, as well as the University of New England and the University of Maine Graduate School. Chief March, thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, Jennifer, and glad to be here. Thank you.
Moving between campus law enforcement and being the U.S. Marshal seems to be a unique story for law enforcement careers. Can you tell us a little bit about your early career and how you ended up with such a unique background?
Well, that's part of the long and continuing story, Jennifer. The date of August 4th, 1980 is when I was first sworn in as a full-time police officer, but I'd like to add for any law enforcement officers who are listening, they probably have a story not dissimilar to mine. There was some influence, there was some impression made early on that really triggered that spark of interest of this calling of police service, being a guardian in the community. And we all, at one time or other, in our job interview or otherwise, have declared that we want to help people and make a difference. And that's what a calling is. In my case, as a 12-year-old boy, I met a deputy sheriff in Maine. I lived in Connecticut at the time, but I met the deputy sheriff who explained to me when I asked the question, why do you have a shotgun in the back of your car? Now, I knew he was a police officer, but what do you do with that shotgun? And that deputy thought for a moment, and he said, well, Noel, I protect myself with that shotgun, but more importantly than that, I protect others who can't protect themselves. And I'll tell you, Jennifer, that led really to some introspection on my part, even as a 12-year-old boy, to think about just how noble that role is. The one who is called upon when you're afraid or vulnerable, and you need help when you can't help yourself, and it's the police officer that is asked to come help. And I saw that deputy sheriff, who later, sadly, would be killed in the line of duty. But I saw him as 10 feet tall and quite heroic. And I don't think it was just, the impressions of a young boy at the time, because I came to learn quite a bit about that man, and I tried to emulate some of what he did in his life. So if we have a mentor or a person who is an inspiration to us that leads us into this profession, or someone that helps us grow within the profession, I think that's always a good strategy, and we're fortunate we have people in our lives that can do that for us.
Well, your story just goes to show no conversation is necessarily insignificant. You know, here's that man talking to a 12-year-old boy who had no idea later on that little boy would grow up to be a chief, a U.S. Marshal. I mean, that's amazing. And he lost his life in the line of duty.
He did, on duty. Unfortunately, it was a terrible car crash, not his fault. He was responding to a drug investigation case in progress, and he never reached that case. But, you know, his family and I are still friends to this day, and his daughters, and our lives do go on. You know, as a police officer in Meriden, Connecticut, that summer of 1980, I soon went to the police academy. But during my academy time on a particular weekend, my partner, the man that I'd been hired with, who was also in the academy with me, off duty, fell into a deadly force situation where he was acting as a police officer in interrupting a felony in progress. Those individuals who were committing the crime tried to kill him. He had to defend himself with deadly force. That resulted in a demonstration in our city against the police. It was a conflict that involved race. And city members from Hartford, Connecticut had come to protest the police department, asking for that police officer to be fired and so forth. We see these, and this, here we are, you know, 40 years later, and we're seeing these incidents occur in our communities still to this day. But my point is that it was the following weekend that 35 hooded Ku Klux Klansmen showed up on the front steps of our city hall. Now, this is the state of Connecticut. And here we are in the month of March, 1981. Little did any of us know that there was a cell of Klansmen in Connecticut. And they had called upon their imperial wizard from Alabama, Bill Wilkinson, to come and lead them in a support protest, counter protest, in support of the police, which we wanted nothing to do with. Neither did the approximately 3,000 citizens who showed up to defy the Ku Klux Klan being present in Meriden, Connecticut. That devolved into a riot, and 23 of our 30-some-odd police officers, I was present that morning with a hard hat and a wooden baton. We weren't equipped nor trained, but approximately 30 of us were there in a line, uniformed police officers, standing in front of the Ku Klux Klan with their bullhorns and their signs, their picket signs on sticks made of baseball bats and axe handles. Support your local police. I'll tell you, that was a tipping point in my early career when I began to really appreciate the depth and breadth of hate and the power of our Constitution's First Amendment as well, juxtaposed, and we ran to get those hooded Klansmen out of town onto buses, and the rocks and bricks flew. And officers were injured. Klansmen were injured. Members of the community were as well in that stampede. That night, we were on the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. Little did we know the previous day that the national spotlight would be on Meriden, Connecticut. But it was a day also for me to decide that I needed to stand for peace, and I needed to stand for victims' rights. I needed to stand for fairness, equality, and understanding. And I made that commitment at that time. And I think that that led to the way I would carry out my work and the way my profession would unfold over the course of the years ahead.
It's a tipping point in your career. It sounds like to me a moment that shaped you as a man, as a human being.
It did indeed. My father was a first-generation American. He was a U.S. Army World War II liberator of imprisoned people in one of the Buchenwald concentration camps in April of 1945, serving under General George Patton. My great-grandfather was an immigrant to this country and a Russian Jew. My great-great-grandfather was a member of the Union Army and was killed on September 16th of 1862 in the Battle of Antietam. And the reason I share these is that these pieces of my background, because that also helped shape who I am today and what I believe. The Battle of Antietam was the tipping point as well in the Civil War when President Lincoln, at the conclusion of that bloody day, authored the Emancipation Proclamation. And from that day forward, the Civil War would be nearly solely about the abolition of slavery. So these ingredients of my own family story, thank goodness my great-great-grandfather had one child left back home in Connecticut, because from that one child came my entire family. So these are the stories that affect us personally and hopefully will help shape us for who we are to be and carry on, you know, family heritage and our commitment to each other.
Talk about the uniqueness of policing a campus. You're talking about residents who are young, energetic, vocal.
Sure.
Some of them away from home for the first time, maybe perhaps not the best decision makers in their social hours. What has been the uniqueness of that, and what would you offer for those who are in campus policing have been your keys to success?
Those who have followed the path of campus policing or public safety know this to be true, that of these 4,200 approximately colleges and universities across this country, each one represents a very well-defined and quite diverse community. They're almost like a town within a town. And they're made up of a demographic, as you pointed out, Jennifer, of mostly young people. Many of them out of their homes for the first time. Not all of them, of course. Many of them sleeping away at college. Not all do. Some commute. But here we will find that almost every state is represented in so many of the student bodies of our colleges and universities, as well as international students and scholars that come to study or work at our colleges and universities. So you can have a fairly rich melting pot of often quite idealistic and sometimes unrealistic young people. But this is the role, this is the job of higher education, to form and to educate and give experience to these young people such that they come out as more enlightened. Now, their challenges are numerous, but the opportunities are even more so. There are about 30,000 public safety officers among these colleges and universities across the country that are protecting these campus communities and the faculty, staff, and students that reside or work there. About a third of those 30,000 are sworn police officers, and the rest are non-sworn public safety officers. They share the same responsibilities but have a different mix of authority that comes with those various versions of protector. What I have found is that the students are great. They really are. And they are experimenting with pushing the envelope on these new freedoms that they have. But the officers can be and should be educators first and enforcers last. And part of what we know in community-oriented policing is that if enforcement is the first order of business, it typically means that nothing else worked, everything else failed, and the different options and efforts to gain voluntary compliance with the law and to gain appreciation for respect and responsibility for one another's rights and property have not been successful. The police officer on a college campus can model what a student and faculty and staff should expect from police officers in the communities of their own homes or the communities within which they will reside in the future. And that's a very big responsibility. You're setting a bar of modeling an expectation of public servant as a critical thinker, a communicator, which means being a listener, and being a problem solver with that member of the community, and being a police officer who is part of the campus community, not apart from the campus community.
I was on the campus of Virginia Tech University shortly after those shots rang out as a reporter in my former life. Campus violence is something that must keep you up at night. The potential of it, the possibility of it from happening. It just seems that no place is safe. When you have Sandy Hook Elementary and you have schools and universities and if you had to, like, a pie chart, how would you break up sort of, here's what Chief Marsh worries about or is concerned about in terms of divisive events, the division as it is right now, potential of problems arising out of differences of opinions between people, wanting to hurt students on your campus. Are they on the pie chart? Do they take up a large part? What are your focuses?
Well, I think it's impossible to put a percentage on or measure concern or probability of the threat. But what we have now is more information, sadly, more experience, and fortunately, a greater understanding of mental health issues, of what the ingredients are, and what the clues and cues, what the red flags are around an individual who's emotionally disturbed and maybe circling the drain toward a bad act. You know, there are far more numbers of interventions of cases where the person of concern did not turn violent. And we were able to get our arms around that individual before it got so bad in their life and their decision-making that they victimized others. We do live in a little bit of a different time, don't we? Where earlier, as a young kid in school, I remember air raid drills where we would, in our case, we would sit in the hallway with our faces between our knees and our hands over our head until the practice was over. And I remember asking once, why are we putting our head between our knees? That was uncomfortable. And I was told that in case the bombs come and the glass explodes in our classroom windows, that we won't be blinded. And I want to tell you that, you know, as a second grader, I found that to be quite terrifying.
You seem to remember that.
I'll remember it forever. Yeah. And you know, the planes and the bombs never came. That doesn't mean that violence won't be visited upon our schools again sometime in the future. But this is a shift. This has been a sea change. But over a course of many years, the 1980s, unfortunately, the U.S. Postal Service was hung with the handle of going postal because there were a number of incidents around, and we don't say postal violence, and there were acts of violence at UB's cafeteria and McDonald's in San Ysidro, California, and we didn't refer to it as restaurant violence. But it's different because of our hearts being so vested in our children, and it shocks the conscience.
And it's happened so much in this country with the school violence.
It has. I certainly don't mean to minimize it, but workplace violence from Microsoft to Amazon to whatever else has occurred, we have found that this is a shift in extreme behavior. You know, when I was a new police officer, and any law enforcement officers that might be listening may relate to this, that earlier in my career, boy, it was something to get a call to go to a bar fight. And what you found at the bar fight was one guy looks at another guy, or another guy looks at your girlfriend. And what do you look at? And this thing slowly ramps up to finally chairs get pushed back and maybe a swearing and a shove. Let's take this outside. And it takes quite a while to get to the point where fists are being thrown. What I've seen in my career is that has accelerated to one cross look turns into a blitz of a chair being broken over your head or being stabbed or maybe being shot on the spot. Right. So you've stepped in my sneakers and now you're going to die. It's, you know, that's an extreme example that I've just offered, but you understand it's going from 0 to 60 in the blink of an eye.
You say extreme and sadly a real.
It's reality. It's different. Yeah. It's different now.
That's scary.
It is, but I also tell anyone who cares to listen, your listeners here, as well as what I tell students at our university, don't live alarmed. Don't be afraid. Live aware.
Live aware. Now, speaking of your sage advice, are there? I understand that you have a degree in peace and reconciliation studies from the University of Maine. Wow. That is not a discipline that I think is common for many professionals in law enforcement, although I think it should be. I didn't even know it existed. I don't know if they offered it at my college. How has that influenced your work?
The backstory there is that as I have continued to hopefully mature professionally and became a father of three beautiful children and came to appreciate my father's own story of liberating a concentration camp, he shared with me just before he died. It was the longest conversation he and I ever had in my life. He finally told me, those World War II guys don't speak of their experiences, but he finally told me of what he saw at that terrible place. See, my dad was in seminary. He was going to be a Catholic priest before enlisting in the army. He didn't step foot in church again after the war, having seen things that his eyes could never unsee, and him being in a place of questioning the very existence of God, because how could one man do something so terrible to another man? And I thought on that and wanted to further my understanding of how can we prevent the violence? How can we prevent the pain? Being proactive, being a practitioner of community-oriented policing, we find strategies to keep the crime from occurring in the first place and not being reactive to try to pick up the pieces after the fact. Peace studies, whether it be hate crime intervention and involvement, whether it be engaging ourselves with our vulnerable communities, learning from one another, understanding one another, would help prevent crime. And I believed that, and I wanted to know more about that. I'd long wanted to have a graduate degree, and having worked for the university, I had the opportunity to do that.
How does the handling or classification of a hate crime on campus differ from the handling or classification of hate crimes that occur in the broader community? Is there a difference?
The short answer is no, there is not a difference, but the longer answer is it is handled in a much better fashion. And the reason we're able to do that, well, first, let me point out, as I alluded earlier, there are a number of backgrounds and cultures and experiences, both demographic, geographic, sociographic, from all over the world found on a college campus. So there is apt to be conflict, and there's apt to be misunderstandings, and there's apt to be hate that comes with the misunderstandings. Gosh, after 9/11 of 2001, our college and university campuses were found to have an uptick in hate incidents towards a Sikh student from India because those who practice may wear a turban, and the local student from town who doesn't know the difference, doesn't have the cultural competency to understand the differences, engages in hate behavior. Now, what we have at a college and a university typically is a multidisciplinary. You have an approach of a counseling center, a dean of students, a multicultural director, a public safety or police leader, and student leadership, all under the same roof, where we have resources to circle the wagons around the incident and around the students and help them to understand. And I have found, Jennifer, that peer-to-peer empowerment, where we have students correcting other students' behavior. It's not the grown-ups telling the youngsters what to do, what not to do, or say. It's one another setting a tone of not just tolerance, but inclusion and respect and understanding and support for one another. And isn't it interesting when the students team up around the victim and call out the bully, that the power imbalance shifts? And it's not a dissimilar scenario when there is a hate incident to see the students of a university or a college rally around and say, no, that's not who we are as a community. That is not the standard or the value that we embrace. And we are going to make our voices, our feelings, and our position on this known. We can't always pull that off in the community at large. We have a much better opportunity and chance at success in a campus setting.
One of the things that I was really curious about and wanted to talk to you about was the fact that you are dealing with the age group that you're dealing with. And on the subject of hate crimes, is there any level of difficulty in discerning between, I'm dealing with, this is a clear-cut racist incident, or is this an immature human being who still, quite frankly, is a child and lacks judgment, but the repercussions of his or her behavior is having an impact.
Sure.
So if I don't deal with this in a certain way, I could cause more issues. How do you navigate through that?
Well, in the scenario that you've just offered, we use an approach called restorative justice. And that's where, if it's pretty clear to us that it's a student's ignorance,
sure,
naivety and immaturity that has them using slang or slurs or insults that they may have been accustomed to on the playground from wherever they came and may not have been called out and held accountable on. In our community, they will be. And if we can organize, and we do, a peer-to-peer, listen, I think the word is social science is intervention, But if we can have the person who has to be held accountable sit face to face and eyeball to eyeball with those whose words have those words have hurt, we can build some understanding. That's the educational opportunity. And we've seen change. We've seen maturity and understanding come to light. Now, there's a difference between a hate incident and a hate crime, and they need to be approached differently. But it's a community solution. It's a community response, and not solely a police response. Matter of fact, in most cases, police should not be at the lead of setting community standards. Our police should be supporting those community standards with fair and equal treatment, enforcement, and expectations. And this speaks a little bit to something that we were talking about just earlier, and that is, as police, we have to make deposits into what I call the community trust bank account every single day, every opportunity we have. Because when the time does come that there's a flashpoint of hate and the kind of emotional response that's apt to come from a community, if the police are involved in that, or the police are expected to respond to that, what you have to be ready for is to make a hefty withdrawal from that community trust bank account. Because you want your community to say, oh good, our police are here, they will know what to do. Or I know that they will help us because they always have. You don't want it to be said, finally, they're getting their comeuppance. Or these guys it's now our turn to finally show that we've had it. It makes a huge difference if you have trust, confidence, and credibility as a police service, a public safety officer, or a public safety department, coming in as a guardian and as a problem solver and as part of the solution, as opposed to already having been viewed as part of the problem.
That sharing is so key. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Beat. The Beat is brought to you by the United States Department of Justice's COPS Office. The COPS Office helps to keep our nation's communities safe by giving grants to law enforcement agencies, developing community policing publications, developing partnerships, and solving problems. If you have comments or suggestions, please email our response center at askcopsrc@usdoj.gov or check out our social media on Facebook, www.facebook.com/DOJ Cops, on YouTube, www.youtube.com/C/DOJ Cops Office, or on Twitter @Cops Office. Our website is www.cops.usdoj.gov. The opinions contained herein are those of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the U.S. Department of Justice. References to specific agencies, companies, products, or services should not be considered an endorsement by the authors or the U.S. Department of Justice. Rather, the references are illustrations to supplement discussion of the issues.